Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters at Home. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
And I'm Tamsy Thompson.
For the sixth episode of Architecture Masters at Home, we're joined by Maria Louise Long, Senior Associate at Chris Dyson Architects. Hello, Maria Louise.
Hello, it's great to speak with you.
Maria Louise grew up in Southwest Ireland and went on to study architecture in Aberdeen at the Scott Sutherland School of Architecture, before moving to London some 10 years ago in search of work during the global financial crisis. She joined the practice after a short period working on a construction site and worked her way up from a Parts U student to senior associate, now leading on many of the practice's projects. The practice, founded in 2004, has won great acclaim for its conservation and restoration work and is increasingly working on larger commercial schemes. We spoke to Chris in episode 5 of Architecture Masters back in 2017. Having outgrown their original studio, in 2014 the practice moved to a former pub in London Spitalfields. The practice proceeded to completely redesign, overhaul and restore the building whilst working from it. But today, as with all Architecture Masters at Home episodes, we join Maria Louise down the line from her home.
Thanks for coming on today. I guess we should start by asking you, obviously the office is normally based on the edge of the city in Fashion Street, but I'm presuming you're not speaking from there today?
No, I'm currently speaking from my bedroom. My current working office is at a desk shared with two others in my living room, so I thought I'd better hibernate in the bedroom away from the noise for this call.
And How are you and the practice finding the new working arrangements? Is it going well so far?
Yeah, I think we've kind of gotten into a working arrangement now, where obviously it came as quite a shock to us all. It was very sudden. I guess we'd globally kind of heard what was going on, but it was a very quick change from, I think it was now, it's coming up on 3 weeks ago, that initially there was a few of us who commute from kind of further afield that started to implement the working from home first. There was a couple of members that were in walking distance that continued in the initial days, but then, yeah, coming up on 2 weeks ago, it was made a decision that it was important as part of the government advice for all of us to make the change and start working from home.
And what does that actually mean for you as a practice? How is it sort of affected positively or negatively your kind of day-to-day creative work processes?
Yeah, I guess the main thing with the practice is, and I'm sure a lot of other architectural practices work in the same means, but certainly within our practice we're very team-based, so the way the business is kind of structured out is, you know, we have Chris and Matt, who's another partner in the company, who oversee all the works, but then we kind of have a tiered system. So there is me as one of the associates, then the architects and assistants, and on each project we do very much collaborate between all levels, so it is quite taking some getting used to, rather than, you know, popping down the stairs or across into the room or just turning to the person beside you to have a quick chat, that, you know, you are having to be more considerate in that communication and keeping that open. Certainly at the moment it is, like, as part of my role it would be very much overseeing the work of the more junior members, so I am very much aware of just trying to check in with them regularly. We have, as a team in general, we in the office have like Monday morning meetings, and we've continued to implement them through like Zoom, so that everyone is kind of seeing each other and still feeling as part of the team as we go on. We had one or two members that had recently started, so we're particularly conscious that they are up to speed and kind of, you know, learning from us at a distance.
And I guess you've got a very beautiful office designed by yourself.
Yes, indeed.
Haven't you? With some really nice communal areas.
Yeah.
So it must be hard to kind of virtually recreate the kind of communal kitchen and in those spaces.
Yeah, certainly. I suppose as architects, we're very much aware of creating environments that are, you know, optimize productivity and, you know, working to spaces that generally create happier environments to work in, which, you know, when you're designing a workspace, it's very much key about, you know, light levels and sound and all that kind of aspects, which trying to implement in your living room can kind of become difficult. But yeah, it's certainly, you know, we're all adapting to the spaces that we're working within. Yeah, with Fashion Street, which you mentioned, we had been on a bit of a journey with that, where when we first moved to that office, it was before all the development. So we actually went through the full construction works with us in situ. So we've gone through the ups and downs of not having all the privileges of good quality design while we worked through the construction process. So I guess we know that there's that good aspect to return to, hopefully in the near future.
Yeah, I remember visiting you, and at one point it very much was a building site with you guys camped out.
Yes, it was. We did exactly what we tell all our clients not to do in terms of staying in the project while they do works. So it's a definite no-go, but yeah, I think it's at least we can say to the clients now we certainly know how they feel when the building works are going on. But like any project, I guess, yeah, what you're working to gain in the end is feels very much worth it.
I'm always really interested in, I guess we see a lot of architects designing their own homes, which I guess is one thing that they kind of, and the family are the only people who are going to kind of be seeing the house. But the idea of designing your own office, you must be the kind of, I don't know, just the possibility, not criticism really, but if you're designing something for other people who are going to be critically thinking about the space, it's quite, was there one person in the practice who kind of took the lead for the design of Fashion Street and your office? I mean, everyone else must have new ideas or other things they're kind of suggesting. It must be a real challenge to be the one person kind of leading that design for a team.
Yeah, it's certainly, and like I mentioned in the other works, that it tends to be on any project a collaborative element. So it was nothing different on that project, where we kind of, yeah, as you know, Chris did kind of a national sketch designs, but we all had review of the drawings and certain inputs, and you know, just in relation to, we now have a terrace at the top of the building, which is an amazing space for the office to have, and one that I think just came about through discussion when we were all having a look at the design initially. And just that space now to have, you know, unfortunately we're not appreciating it at the moment with this glorious weather, but yeah, to have that, you know, as a facility for the office, either at lunchtime, or we often have, you know, social gatherings or whatever on the roof, and something like that developed from, you know, just discussing our needs and desires for the office is hugely beneficial.
But it takes a certain kind of confidence, though, I guess. I mean, designing for people who aren't themselves architects, in a sense, they're not going to, they're going to be happy with an amazing design. But other people designing for architects must be really challenging, mm-hmm. you know, where people have got other solutions or other suggestions or other kind of ideas, and how you accommodate all of them into a final design.
Yeah, it's certainly, just the question brings to mind that I am on our previous studio to the rear of Chris's house. I had the privilege at the outset to work in that studio initially. But yeah, when we'd moved offices and went to develop that studio, Chris tasked me with running that project, which I'm sure you can imagine, doing a project where your boss is the client is slightly terrifying, but also, yeah, it was a huge privilege. And, you know, just obviously there's an ongoing conversation with him, and just learning through what Chris's teachings and stuff across the years, that, you know, it was amazing for him entrusting me to
implement that project.
So you've been with the practice for...
It's coming on 10 years now. So this is my 10th year. Yeah, so I joined as a part two assistant. So it's, I kind of joined initially. There was no position actually available when I first discussed with Chris. But at the time, I just moved from Aberdeen where I'd studied, and it was probably, a different scale of what we're going to face now, but it was just after the recession, and there was kind of, downturn on available practices, offering jobs and things like that. So I'd initially planned on staying in Scotland, but the job opportunities just seemed to present themselves more in London. So when I initially moved here, I thought I'd take the opportunity to work in a construction site. So I'd actually just started with a construction company, shadowing them, learning from them. And it was through that company that they were working on a project with Chris, and he'd become aware that I was doing this. And I was just interested in that side, that I was working and finding out about construction also. So yeah, I initially met with him, and we spoke about me being involved in one or two projects initially, because there wasn't a full-time position available at the time. But yeah, 10 years later, still here. So that was...
And how big was the practice then, 10 years ago?
It was about 12 people. So 12 to 14 was kind of the numbers at that time. We're up on 19 at the moment, but that kind of involves, all the assistants, and then some people on maternity leave and our administration staff. So it kind of fluctuates, 15 to 20 people.
Yeah. I guess that the practice has developed a reputation for conservation work, and some incredibly beautiful work at that. But I guess Chris started his career working in what I guess you might describe as more commercial practices. And now you're working on kind of bigger and more commercial-based schemes. And I wondered how those two sort of things marry up within the practice, and how that's kind of evolved the style and the practice approach to design.
Yeah, I think as an underlying thing, probably the approach to design will always remain the same, in that, we aim to create these meaningful spaces. And if you're, regardless of the scale and size of the project, if it's considered brief with a sensitive response, you'll always result in kind of a functional and appropriate design that meets the requirements of the client. Just on, with Chris's development, he's obviously, and I think, anyone that knows Chris will know he's a huge character, and just the energy and creativity that comes from him kind of evolves across any aspect, so any scale. Generally, we have developed within, as you mentioned, historic context and in conservation areas. And even as we go into more commercial elements, there, a lot of the time it will be clients who are drawn to us due to that kind of that approach to the historic setting. There might be, specific constraints on the site where it's due to develop. For instance, on a current project I'm working on, it's based on Rosendale Road, and it's just off Brockwell Park there. And that is, it's within a conservation area, very sensitive site. And that is, it, for me personally, it's one of the bigger projects I've worked on, where it's currently looking for planning at 34 units. But just through the development in that, I guess it was still the same approaches that we've always taken in terms of, the context, looking at the history of the setting. That particular project has a facade which is locally listed. So we looked at the retention of that facade and restoring that facade, but then following through on our design, our underlying design values in creating the the development beyond, which, yeah, taking the same principles, I guess, that you'd apply to a single dwelling and applying it to the larger 34 unit scheme. With that one, we were very happy because we did a local public consultation, and the feedback was amazing, and it was just great to see something that you're proposing with, where such a wide spectrum of people were so favourable of it. I guess for me personally, just from going from often working on for one-off clients, it was just great to see the public appreciation for that larger scheme.
And I guess that is very much what, as a practice, you're kind of renowned for, isn't it? That sensitivity to working in a sensitive context, whether that's the Crystal Palace Park one, project springs to mind, but also, yes. As you said, working in a lot of conservation areas. But I think the thing that draws me to your work, draws me to the practice work, is this kind of referencing, I suppose, the context, but not being a slave to it. And I think that's a really kind of, I wonder mm-hmm. where that comes from and how, it's quite a fine line to tread, but it's done really well. So I always wonder how those conversations evolve in the office.
I think it always starts with, there is definite a sensitivity to, you know, finding out firstly about the site, what was there, and just learning all the history as much as possible about the particular site. And then not trying to marry those where you're creating something that enhances, you know, something that might be next to it, that you're trying to preserve, and just, you know, but not pastiche architecture. Mm-hmm. So looking to create something that will last in its own right next to, you know, often these amazing conservation projects that are so spectacular in their own right, then it can be a balancing act to compete with, but very rewarding. Just one that I think of is, so the Sackford project, it's the Baron Clerkenwell that we worked on, and yeah, it was one that I was personally again involved in. And initially, when the client came to us, they'd already been through a pre-application or planning, I can't remember, but a stage with another architect, and they approached us because they'd been unsuccessful, and they felt like they needed someone who would be more sympathetic to the conservation area. Now, initially on that one, I don't know if you know the project, but we have the historic pub, and then there was an infill site on the left hand side, which was the old yard to service the bar. And one of the comments at the time was that we couldn't infill that site because it was historically the yard, and that they wanted to retain that going forward. But then we were able to discover a map that it dated back to 1800s or something, that actually showed an infill of the area with a small outbuilding, and we were able to utilise that to then make our argument for infilling that site and creating, well, what we think anyway is this amazing residential development, but at the same time stepping it away and still allowing the main building to breathe and be able to see that original site facade through the glazed link.
Yeah, and I guess that's a really good example of a building that kind of the new elements reference the historic but aren't slavish to it. You know, you read it very much as as a new piece.
Mm-hmm. I think exactly that we don't want people, you know, even non-architects, to come along and not appreciate that is a new element. You know, we want it to read differently. Traditional aspects, but executed in a more modern way. So it's just the design, even of how we've executed the brickwork and things, that, you know, even to a person that's not that familiar with construction and architecture would be able to read that as a separate newer element compared to the historic Sackford itself.
You talked then, obviously working on historic or kind of conservation projects and coming to London and working on those projects. You're not, you can probably tell, again, it's the thing I love about podcasts, the people's accents. You can just, you can tell they're not from London originally, from, I guess, rural, rural South West Island, via Scotland.
Right. I left a long time ago, but I don't seem to have shaken the accent,
I mean, coming to big kind of working in a big metropolis and kind of people often talk about early influences and just kind of interested really in you say via studying in Scotland.
Yeah. So I guess even almost Scotland was like a stepping stone between the two extremes. So where I grew up was on a dairy farm in the middle of green fields with not that many neighbours around. So a very two different extremes to where I am now. Yeah, initially when I was younger, there was very little knowledge I even had of the architectural profession. I was, kind of very removed from it, from your standard surroundings. But it's just, kind of looking back, I think my initial interest was just, it was through history lessons and stuff. I just became very obsessed with ancient Greek and Roman architecture. So I think from an onset, I was just very intrigued on the historic aspect of architecture and just how the buildings were created at that time, just using man and animals and labor and how they constructed those magnificent pieces of architecture at the time. And I think it's definitely something that's followed through in my architecture, just the interest in how actual the buildings go together in the construction, as well as the overall design side of things. I studied in Scott Sutherland in Aberdeen, and even when looking at the architectural courses, that was they have quite an interesting aspect of not just along with the architectural philosophy side, they have an in-depth module just on building technology and construction, and it was kind of one of the reasons I was drawn to that particular course as well. And something, I just think it's very important for architects to understand the buildings that they're designing in the full makeup, and even how they can improve on materiality and all that kind of aspect in our designs.
And so when you were talking about working on a construction site, what sort of work were you doing then in London? When you first moved?
Oh, it was very, very, very just more observation than lifting any construction blocks. I think it was an invaluable experience to me. I was able to visit a number of different sites that either were at later construction stage or early development. I remember there being a basement dig under the full length of a house. And it was just seeing, I guess, being able to sit in on the construction meetings where there was, the architectural team and everything present, it just gave me that other side and knowledge, being able to see it from the construction aspect and implementing the architect's details on site.
And I guess then just finally, we're kind of interested in how things are changing and within practice and for you and I guess the wider kind of profession and maybe the wider city really, about what you hope will change as a result of what we're all going through now and through new ways of working perhaps. Are there any optimistic things you think might change for the better, or kind of whether that's the city or whether that's within the profession itself?
I think maybe people will be more, because at the moment, everyone's confined to certain hours leaving their homes. So on an immediate surrounding clients, I feel like, it's hard not to pay attention at the moment to kind of the physical realm. And I just feel like that it might be a case where people who have not previously necessarily seen the value of good design, and in hiring architects might start to consider, you know, the importance of the space that surrounds them and how it can affect your well-being, your health, or how you can enjoy the space. Obviously, being confined to a space for this unprecedented example is slightly different. But I think it will maybe have people even prioritizing what they want from their space. I'm lucky here, I'm right beside Clapham Common, so I get to go out and enjoy that even though I don't have a back garden. And I think it is the value of people, you know, looking and reassessing what they actually want from the spaces they inhabit and the importance of good design. And then looking at a wider idea of the city itself, I think, I can't see it not having a long-term impact on just us as designers, how we think about spaces, just that whole thing of working from home. I do think it would be a shame, certainly in an architectural profession, to completely move to a working at home setting. Because as I said earlier, it's just, I feel like even from your architectural studies stage, it's so, where you're working in the studio setting at university stage and you're bouncing off, you know, your peers. And then I feel like that's very much brought into the actual profession when you come to the office stage. And I feel like just from my own experience working up through in the office, you know, I learned so much from being in a setting where I'm overhearing Chris or other more senior members of staff having conversations that I might not be partaking in. But you just learn so much from being in that office environment and setting, and being able to bounce ideas and have chats through with the rest of the team also.
The kind of passive learning, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I think we're all looking forward to being back as a team and seeing each other and just chatting through ideas and things. Lovely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
Okay, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters at Home. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
And I'm Tamsie Thompson. Thank you for listening.